All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen is presiding. All who have business before this court, draw near and you will hear it. God bless the United States and His Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Well, good morning, everybody. I'm Judge Allen. To my right is Judge Toth. To my left is Judge Falvey. And before we get down to business this morning, I just want to welcome a couple of groups of people here to the court. We have a group of interns from the Department of Veterans Affairs Office of General Counsel. So we want to welcome you to the court. And we also have a number of people who are participating in the Wake Forest Law School Judicial Externship Program here in DC, and we welcome you as well. So with that, we are here to consider argument today in the matter of James W. Rory versus Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, case number 225377. Would counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, please enter your appearance for the record? Morning, Secretary.
James Drysdale on behalf of the Secretary. With me is Chris Wallace, Deputy Chief Counsel.
Welcome to both of you. And we can begin. I understand you've reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. All right. So we'll make that happen, and you can start when you'd like.
May it please the court. The language of the regulation 38 CFR 3.157 is clear. It's not ambiguous. Words, the meanings in those words were understood in the mid-1980s when the regulation at issue in this court today. Claim for increased benefits and claim to reopen were clearly understood.
Could I stop you? And I'm sorry to interrupt you right at the beginning, okay? Let's just pretend that there's never been a case called Pachinko, never out there in the world. Nobody has ever interpreted 3.157B, okay? Are you with me on my hypothetical?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. I'm going to ask you to essentially give me the elevator speech about your argument, which is articulate for me an interpretation of 3.157B under which your client can prevail.
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. Okay, so 3.157B allows for when an initial claim has been granted, allows for the receipt of an examination report to serve as an informal claim, either as a claim to reopen or a claim for increased benefits. The or in that regulation allows for either increased benefits or a claim to reopen. So in Mr. Rory's case, he filed a claim way back in the 1970s for a bilateral foot disability, and that claim was granted. It was granted. The VA diagnosed him with pes planus. They granted a pes planus claim or disability. But his claim was for bilateral foot claim that was granted. So this regulation allows for him, because then VA bifurcated his bilateral foot claim into pes planus and tibia pedis, allows him to produce the examination report as an informal claim for either increased benefits or a claim to reopen.
So let me follow up with one other question. Until your supplemental brief in this case, including back way when this case was before me the first time as a single judge, your client always articulated the state of the play as this being a denied claim, right? So the first time we get the idea that the way we should look at this in the context of 3.157B is in your supplemental claim, where you've articulated a theory that you've just articulated, that this actually falls into a formal claim for compensation that has been allowed, right? Why should we not say that your client has forfeited, or perhaps waived, but at a minimum, forfeited the argument that we should consider this as a claim that has been allowed as opposed to a claim that has been disallowed?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Rory, again, is a pro se in the 1970s and the 1980s. All he can do is articulate what he's bringing his compensation.
I'm not talking about when he was pro se. I'm talking about, let's just take this case. Your opening brief, he wasn't pro se, right? Okay. So you wrote the brief, and your position was this was about a disallowed claim. You can read that brief and the reply brief over and over and over again, and you will never see an argument that this is about a claim for compensation that has been allowed. That first comes into play in your supplemental brief. And what I just want to know is what's your best shot at telling us that we should be able to consider that as opposed to saying that that argument was forfeited?
Well, it was only disallowed, Your Honor, because of the way that VA characterized that his original claim. This issue maybe wasn't fully developed. Secretary didn't, say that it didn't apply because of for that basis.
Well, the secretary never had a chance in writing to say that because your supplemental brief, it was only in a supplemental brief. And the claim is either allowed or disallowed, right? I mean, are you saying this is both a claim that is allowed and a claim that is disallowed?
Yeah, they're both part of the bilateral foot claim. I mean, that's what VA did essentially, right? I mean, they granted the pes planus part and then they disallowed the tibia pedis part.
So disallowed is the same to you as denied?
Right. Yes. Yes, Your Honor. I mean, they granted part, I mean, his they granted the bilateral foot claim, but they couched it as only a pes planus disability. But again, under Ingram, it's not Mr. Rory's responsibility to, know how his foot claim is being diagnosed. That's not his responsibility. He's bringing a claim for compensation for his bilateral foot claim, and he was clear from the beginning in the 70s and 80s that he was articulating the symptoms of his bilateral foot claim were both the pronation of his feet and his infection on the feet, and he brought that up through the several appeals in the late 70s and early 80s. It was VA that then characterized it as something else.
So assuming that you could win on the theory you've just articulated, right? Because if you didn't have a theory that you could win, then it wouldn't matter whether Pachenko is undermined or not. But let's assume you could win on that and that it's not forfeited. What is your best argument about why we as a three-judge panel, can essentially not simply say you're bound by Pachenko?
The court decision in Kaiser supersedes Pachenko. It overturned the reasoning and rationale in Pachenko.
So, but what particularly? Because I think that, and because this is important, because as we're speaking now, the Supreme Court is announcing decisions down on First Street, right? And who knows what decision they're going to do, but someday they're going to decide the cases about Chevron, right? Which will then have an impact. Here we have Kaiser. If we just went the extent to which you just articulated it, we'd say every case ever decided that was under our automatically needs to be reconsidered. Are you saying that?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, those cases existed prior to the decision in Kaiser, but after Kaiser, the date of Kaiser's decision moving forward, the Supreme Court has spoken on how the courts are to interpret agency regulations. So once Kaiser was in effect, now the court, as the cases come up, need to follow the Kaiser framework.
I mean, there's no doubt that Kaiser's forward-looking, so that, I mean, if we're reviewing an agency interpretation for the first time that there's no precedent on, we would do so differently. But I mean, I read the Kaiser. I mean, Justice Kagan says one of the reasons that they don't overturn our is because that would call into question all the precedent where courts have deferred to agencies. I mean, she actually just says literally quite that. What do you make of that?
Well, again, she says that we, although that they're not overturning it, there's a law review article that is out there from Georgetown Law Review that says essentially Seminole Rock and Auer looked like Hiroshima after Enola Gay dropped a bomb on it. I mean, they may not have overturned Seminole Rock and Auer, but in a sense, they eviscerated it. And again, moving forward, we have a Supreme Court precedent. It would be the same thing if this was a statute, if the Congress had changed their mind. now moving forward, we the courts are to look at it through the Kaiser lens.
So you started out by saying that 3.157B was not ambiguous. Okay, so that's of course at odds with the all nine judges on the en banc court in Pachinko. So explain to me your understanding of how 3.157B is not ambiguous, but in a way that your client wins.
Well, again, as long as the first part of that regulation is met, it's not ambiguous because these words have definite meanings. And again, that or, that disjunction or, allows for independent basis for entitlement. So it can be a claim to reopen or a...
But why wouldn't it be ambiguous, potentially? Because what you're asking us to do is to say that a formal claim for compensation that had been allowed would include any claim related to a body part, a single body part, here the foot, where one claim is allowed and another claim is denied, we would treat under this regulation the denied claim as actually being an allowed claim.
Well, only if the initial claim clearly encompassed that. I mean, Ingram essentially holds that, right? I mean, the veteran can only bring, I want compensation for my foot. There's a problem with it. I need compensation for it. That's all the veteran can do. And so if that is granted, and, you know, just like in a, you know, as time goes on, there may be other problems with that.
But here, your argument is I, Mr. Rory, filed a claim for service connection for a problem with my foot. Okay. VA grants it as a certain condition.
Right.
Later, it articulates a claim for a different foot condition and denies that claim, right?
Right.
But for you to win under 3.157B, the denied claim has to be treated as a claim, a formal claim for compensation that has been allowed, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, I just want to do that. That might be right, but it's really hard to get there by saying, just reading that language, the claim that has been allowed actually is a claim that was denied.
Right. Well, I just want to make it clear that Mr. Rory was clear from the beginning that he mentioned all the symptoms he had on his feet. This is not a situation where, again, that the veteran is bringing something that was completely unrelated years after the fact. He had specifically identified the symptoms.
I know you make a lot of that in your supplemental brief. You bold, you underline, you italicize. I'm not sure why that matters here. Can you articulate for me why that matters?
Again, he was bringing a bilateral foot claim. It encompasses both the tibia pedis and the pes planus. He's a pro se veteran at the time. He's bringing a claim for compensation for his feet. And then they granted it, and he kept couching it as, well, I want an increase. Take a look at my, you know, I'm having more trouble, and I've got this infection. I want an increase on my foot claim. So
are you treating then the claim for service connection for tibia pedis as being a claim for increase?
That's how Mr. Rory understood it. It was only treated as a claim to reopen because of how VA bifurcated the issue.
Well, but it wasn't a claim to reopen until it was denied, right? I mean, right? That's the problem is that I'm having. Again, you might prevail, but it's difficult to say you prevail in a way that your reading is the only reading.
Well, then it's a pending unadjudicated claim. You know, he's raising these symptoms, right? I mean, he's raising this all along together with his foot claim. With his, you know, as one claim. So, I mean, again, based on what he understands, he has a bilateral foot claim. They granted part of it, but they didn't grant the other part, and they bifurcated it. So under the facts of this case, 3.157 is clear, as it existed in the mid-1980s. It allows for a claim for either way. And again, I would just make sure the court understands there's, you know, whether it's clear or not is only the first level. The second level is genuine ambiguity under Kaiser, and that analysis goes to text, structure, purpose, and history before you look at the secretary's or the agency's interpretation. And in this case, that disjunctive or, how statutory construction cases work, allows for independent bases under this regulation, which again allowed for veterans to not have to file a formal claim. They could get an increase based on their, or a claim to reopen based on the examination report.
Let me ask you, I have to go back to this. So as you see it, he had a bilateral foot claim that came in two parts, and one part was allowed and the other was denied, which you see as equivalent of as disallowed. But the regulation says it has to be disallowed for a particular reason. It has to be a disallowed for the reason that the service-connected disability is not compensable in degree. How was his tinea pedis denied claim service-connected at a non-compensable rating?
Right, Judge Fowler, that's not what we're arguing. We're arguing that he had a single claim. In his mind, he brought a bilateral foot claim. It's VA that made them two different things.
It's understandable that they're rated.
So it was granted.
One's muscular and the other is a skin condition.
Sure.
But it makes sense that they would be two different ratings. But how is it that it was disallowed because it was service connected but at a non-compensable rate?
Well, his bilateral foot claim is granted. That was granted. That's what we're arguing. The PES, they granted a certain.
Okay, so this
portion.
Is your supplemental briefing argument.
Right, yes. That is our argument. It was granted. That's how he meets the first part of 3.157B.
You would agree that if we, again, just leave Pacheco and Kaiser off the table, okay? If we reject your argument that the granting of the one condition for the foot brings every foot condition under the compensation has been allowed prong. If we reject that argument, you agree that the tinea pedis claim was not disallowed for the reason that the service-connected disability is not compensable, right?
That's correct.
So you can't, okay. That's helpful. Thank you.
So let me ask you, I mean, it looks like in Pacheco, I mean, the construction they use is kind of one of parallel where, you know, the allowed claim sort of parallels to an informal claim for increased benefits, vice a disallowed claim would then pair with a claim to reopen. And you seem to kind of flip that, right? You would have an allowed claim, and then that would presumably be a claim to reopen.
Right.
What do you make of that kind of parallelism? Why?
We don't follow that, Your Honor.
Why not? I mean, because that was the prevailing view in Pacheco. That was the best reading.
Well, that was their interpretation. But because it allows it, the way that the structure works in 3.157B is that once a formal claim has been allowed or a formal claim for compensation has been disallowed, so there's two independent parts in the first phrase, and then there's two independent parts in the second phrase.
Right, and one tracks three and two kind of tracks four, right?
I don't think that necessarily follows from the text and structure of the regulation. And
well, but following with, you know, to follow on the parallel, right? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time, and have you ever heard of a claim, somebody who's had their claim allowed, seeking to reopen it? I mean, right? Have you ever heard anybody do that? One wouldn't do that. One would say, oh, I've got a claim allowed and it's gotten worse, so I'm going to try to get increased compensation. Why would one ever reopen an allowed claim?
Well, because I think in the 80s and the 70s, when there was not a court to give us clear guidance at the time, lot of things were happening that did not make sense with the Department of Veterans Affairs adjudication. And this is an example, Mr. Rory's case is an example of that.
Can you give me any example where somebody has had service connection granted for a condition and what they do is they reopen that claim?
Well, I don't think that that would be their intent, but it could have been characterized by the VA. I don't have an example offhand, but again, there wasn't a court back then, and stranger things have happened. I mean, there could have been a situation where they characterized it that way. So again, getting back to the text and structure and purpose, again, the court has to make a determination, even if the court were to find this is not clear, whether it's genuinely ambiguous. And under Kaiser, that's the text structure of the regulation. And again, we talked about the or, and that's there's case law on that. But also, you would not want the last phrase to be superfluous, which is another textual structure. I'd also like to call the court's attention to the 1980.
Wait, the last phrase, because I'm sympathetic to the argument that there's a reading of this that favors the veteran, but I don't know if it's yours in the sense that the claim, the disallowed claim would be a claim to reopen, right? And I think you can make a strong argument that something is going to end up being, in a sense, superfluous in this regulation. It's either the disallowed for the reason, what is it, that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't get rated high enough, or claim to reopen.
Let me just interrupt and say, I know your time is over. As long as a judge is asking you a question, you can continue, and I'll give VA additional time as well.
Thank you, Your Honor. But if it was disallowed for the reason that it was not compensable, then there would be a reason for them to bring an increased rating claim, right?
Right. But you're saying, you just said that this would basically render the claim to reopen superfluous.
Right.
As I understand it, when one can match four, there's nothing superfluous. You can have a granted claim, and then as long as maybe a related claim were denied, then you could move to reopen it. I mean, there would be nothing superfluous about that claim to reopen. I know this can get confusing. The regulation's a bit confusing.
Especially because, as I understand it, the phrase today, disallowed by reason of not being compensable in degree, would not be the way it would be done. It would be granted at zero.
Right, and that, yes, Your Honor, and that was as of 1993. I mean, in the Code of Federal Regulations, that's what the Secretary stated, is that that was their practice.
Well, and do you agree that's right? Right, because then, if at the time service-connected disability not compensable in degree was treated essentially as a denial, so you reopen, and now that that's a grant, then frankly there are parts of this that are like the human appendix. At one point in time, they served a purpose, and they just no longer do. Why wouldn't that be what we say? That this regulation is all about increases in severity. It's just at the time, there were different ways that was done by VA.
Well, I think, again, there were different ways that the VA handled claims, and they continue to handle it differently. They weren't consistent. And so to allow for a person in the situation, in the factual scenario of Mr. Rory, then the court should interpret this to allow each of these possibilities, and specifically in 1985, when he was trying, he continued to try to re-raise this claim over and over and over again. So he should be entitled to any benefit in that regulation that allowed it was in existence in 1985.
Judge Toth, do you have any? Judge Fowler? If you want to wrap up, we'll give you a full rebuttal.
That's fine. I have nothing to say, Your Honor. I'll save it for rebuttal.
Great, thank you. Mr. Drysdale. And if you need it, have a couple of extra minutes, although one need not take the extra time.
May it please the court. Judicial doctrines such as the prior restraint rule and stare decisis should guide the court's decision. In the Secretary's view, Kaiser does not stand for the proposition that every case involving our deference should should be relitigated, nor does it stand for the proposition that no case involving the doctrine should be relitigated. Instead, the Secretary recommends that this court adopt Federal Circuit's prior precedent rule as the rule of decision and determine which cases must be relitigated. When applying that rule here, the court should find that Pacheco is not clearly irreconcilable with Kaiser so as to have been effectively overruled, and that prior precedent should not be disturbed. And on that basis, the court should affirm the board's decision. I welcome the court's question.
So does Kaiser disrupt any precedent about agency interpretations?
Well, I believe it can. The Secretary doesn't take the view that it doesn't disturb anything. Under the prior precedent rule has been adopted by the Federal Circuit, if the prior precedent had just said, we take a quick look at it, we don't know what to make of this, we're going to defer to the agency, no further analysis.
And that's what happened in Cantrell. I think that's exactly what happened in Cantrell.
Well, I mean, under that type of analysis where if the reasoning of the prior decision would not be, permissible under the construct of Kaiser now, then I think that is the type of thing that could be relitigated, where you look at whether that decision is sort of clearly irreconcilable with Kaiser. And that should be sort of a guiding, principle for the court to sort of set out a standard for when, these issues should be relitigated or not.
I've got two questions for you, one theoretical and one specific to this case. So the theoretical, I'll throw them out first. You can answer them in whichever order. The theoretical question is, so the Federal Circuit adopted the Ninth Circuit's view from Miller versus Gammy about clearly irreconcilable, right? As far as I'm aware among circuit courts, that's like the highest standard to meet, which of course makes perfect sense in the Ninth Circuit, given the number of judges it has, the number of cases, right? And it also makes an intuitive sense at the Federal Circuit, not so much because they have a huge caseload compared to the Ninth Circuit, but because they actually are bound by regional circuits when dealing with non-patent framed issues, right? So if it's a procedural question, you might look to the Fifth Circuit, the Seventh Circuit, whatever. So having a very high standard makes sense. Does that very high standard make sense for us, number one? That's my theoretical question. The more specific question for this is, what if what we did here, let's just say, was say, this regulation is actually not genuinely ambiguous. Wouldn't that be essentially enough to say, we can't just follow Pacheco? Because Pacheco, they all said, oh, it's ambiguous. But now we know there's got to be more work done about ambiguity. And if we actually found we were at step one as opposed to step two, then isn't it really irreconcilable?
Okay, so a lot in the question. So first of all, I think the court should provide some guidance about what can be relitigated and not. I think that would be helpful for everyone. I think in Kaiser itself, the court did not overturn Auer because it recognized that that really Auer deference was sort of imbued in the whole corpus of administrative law. And I think one of the reasons it did not go the full way to overruling Auer was to prevent the relitigation of every decision that had ever relied on Auer. So I think, just creating a full relitigation of everything is not what was intended. And I think, having some guidance and some structure would be helpful. So yes, the Federal Circuit adopted the Ninth Circuit's sort of prior precedent rule. And the Ninth Circuit, does have the highest standard. And the Federal Circuit has acknowledged that is sort of the most strict version of that standard. I do think it remains appropriate here because this court really does give in the veterans law context sort of great leniency to veterans in a way, the way it reads the law, the way it interprets the law, and So, you know, when it establishes a precedent, it's generally sort of veteran-friendly in a lot of ways. That's sort of baked into the court's jurisprudence, and it's baked into the, you know, way VA, the statutes and regulations are written, and to the way the laws are administered. So once you do have that, judicial interpretation to provide stability in the law, I think, you know, there should be a pretty high standard to overcome that and to, you know, revisit these sort of long-settled issues. So I think it would remain appropriate to, keep that high standard. And also, second, I think the question, if I recall, was really if the court were to find that the regulation itself were not genuinely ambiguous. So I guess the court would find that plain meaning were clear.
I think the Pacheco case is interesting because although it was well for Kaiser, it sort of sounds like they understood some stuff that Justice Kagan was going to say.
Absolutely. It's quite prescient in its reasoning. I mean, it does a lot of what Kaiser asked. It goes through the text, the history.
Well, and that's the interesting point, right? Which is that it does that at step two in assessing whether the agency's interpretation was permissible. And Justice Kagan's opinion seems to suggest those things go at step one, which is, of course, making a determination without deference to the agency. Now, it might be six of one, half dozen of another, right?
That would be my take on it.
Right, but that's the interesting question, right? Which is, does that make a decision in which those types of things are considered as part of the assessment of whether the agency was close enough for government work, right? As opposed to the court independently using those tools at step one, I don't yet have a fully formed view about whether that undermines.
Yeah, and I think prospectively, clearly that would come at step one, but I think when you're looking at overturning a longstanding en banc precedent of this court, sort of the principles of stare decisis, stability in the law, those things should come, also have some weight. I mean, I think. The factors of stare decisis are sort of the most weighty when you're looking at, overturning an en banc precedent. So, what Kaiser really warned against was uncritical deference to the agency, is what it says. And if you read Pacheco, I don't think you can fairly say that decision gave uncritical deference to the agency. It did say it was giving deference, but it wasn't uncritical. It then went through the critical analysis, because there were competing opinions amongst the judges. So they critiqued each other. They critiqued the argument. There was a lot of analysis and deep analysis of those opinions and those arguments. So it went through the text providing deep analysis. It went through the history and the structure. And I'm happy to go into those. But I think just sort of read that decision and the secretary would sort of reiterate why those would sort of give, if the court were to revisit the merits, those would be the same sort of positions that the secretary would advocate now to the court. I mean, I think the history is really significant because, pre-1951, you had sort of increased rating, earlier effective dates for increased ratings based on VA treatment records only. And that's how you get sort of the first sort of parallel part. And then the second part was added in 1951, and those were kind of separate. And then in 1961, they were combined together in this mashup that we now have. You can kind of see, how we got to where we, are. And the purpose of that was never to allow a medical record serve as an informal claim for a condition that had never been service connected. But you have to look at that history, and the court did that in Pacheco. So
what do we do with this? Is like a nasty law school administrative law exam, because we're talking about Pacheco and whether we're bound by that, right? But after Kaiser, there's a panel opinion from this court in Labruzzo that basically says an earlier opinion of the court, it was a panel opinion, but whether it's a panel or en banc doesn't matter for the binding purpose. They just go on to say, in fact, you know, we conclude here that we were, that the earlier case Pantrell saying it, that phrase was ambiguous, it wasn't genuinely ambiguous. Are we bound in some sense to say we have to sort of follow the logic of Labruzzo if we were to say this is not genuinely ambiguous?
Well, I don't think Labruzzo tackled the question head on. So I don't think the panel's bound by it. It didn't, you know, it's sort of
insufficiently reasoned, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, it didn't address, it just kind of skipped over it and assumed that that's what it was supposed to do. It didn't deal with this. And I think that was incorrect, you know, to do that. I think it should have addressed this as sort of the preliminary question of whether it needed to do that. I mean, if I recall, it just said, you know, we necessarily need to do this, and then went right into this without any further discussion of the propriety of doing that.
I was on Labruzzo. So,
hey, sorry, Your Honor.
the underlying case, there never had been a formal interpretation. Neither the agency nor the court had ever sort of hung its hat on anything definitive. There was just a kind of cursory finding of ambiguity. And then the idea was, could you walk back from that? Because it's just a kind of placeholder finding. But it wasn't, I mean, there was no overturning of any, I mean, in fact, I mean, Labruzzo, we sort of chastised the agency for never having, after repeated, you know, requests, coming up with an interpretation.
But in this case, it's quite, you know, different. I mean, I think I would point the secretary toward, I mean, point the court towards the secretary's, you know, sort of longstanding interpretations, which I would say are official and authoritative. You know, we submitted a supplemental authority of a 1984 general counsel opinion that had been referenced, you know, in the 1987 Federal Register.
Sorry to slow you, but I want to ask about the word disallowance. And I know, you know, VA's law is unique here in that very often the regulations sort of predate a statute, right? But I mean, it's clear now that you look at 7104, the word disallowance means denial, right? The board can't re-adjudicate a claim following disallowance. So when did the term disallowance appear? When did it appear in statute to mean denial? I don't mean to put you on the spot, but I'm asking whether in 1985 the term disallowance, if you looked at 38 USC, it would be largely reflective of what it means right now.
Yeah, I don't have the exact date. I do know that in this time, 1985, it was the understanding that a claim that was disallowed due to the reason that the service-connected disability was not compensable in degrees.
I have no doubt that VA is genuine when it says this was how the agency interpreted at the time. But, you know, I mean, Kaiser point one is look at the text. I mean, text words mean what they mean. And if the statute has a pretty clear, I mean, the statute would prevail because technically the regs are interpreting the statute even though they're older. We would have to defer to the statutory meaning. And all of a sudden things change quite a bit because you'd have a denied claim and then you have this weird language that's kind of factually a mistake and then you have the reopen. So, I mean, it definitely plays differently if the word disallowance in 1985 has a clear statutory meaning.
Right. And I don't have the specific date for the first introduction of the statutory, and I'd be happy to do a little research and supplement. Submit a supplement on that.
That's okay.
The history there is sort of about the statutory changes are sort of documented in the 1984 General Counsel opinion and how the sort of statutory scheme changed over time as far as effective dates and how the regulation came about and the interpretation of the regulation kind of changed to align with the evolution of the effective dates. Really, you know, earlier on, the effective date was, you know, from like the 1960s, the effective date could be the day, earliest date that evidence was received showing a condition.
Maybe the term reopen might be an easier way to kind of enter the question, which is, was a reopen claim ever for anything but a denied claim?
Well, it could be, it would have been used in that sort of parlance for a claim that was disallowed because it was not compensable. And I would say that the key word there is compensation. It never says the claim was disallowed. It says compensation was disallowed because it was not to a compensable degree.
You would have viewed that as effectively a denied claim that you need to reopen, not
yes.
Like zero to a 10.
That's right, because the compensation was denied because the disability was not compensable. So they were denied a monetary benefit. Compensation was denied because it was non-compensable to a degree. You were not going to get money because it did not rise to a level to where compensation could be denied. And that was treated as a denied claim in what we would understand now to be denied that would need to be reopened. And that's how that stat, the regulation, that's why it uses the reopen language. And I think that's how, you know, we successfully showed that in Pacheco. And that's what the court sort of understood and you know, reasoned and you know, held that in their opinion as the basis. And I think if you go back and you read through some of the Federal Register statements as it changed and evolved over time and that parlance, you know, changed, now nowadays it's treated as a granted claim, you know, and a 0% rating is assigned. So you would not reopen that. It would be treated as an increased rating. But in the past, that would have been treated as if denied, and then it would need to be reopened because compensation was denied. So, you know, that language has changed in how it was treated. I think as Judge Allen referenced, sort of the human appendix type of problem in there. I did want to say also, I wanted to point the court towards the Federal Circuit's decision in McPhee. We referenced it in the briefing. It wasn't really developed, but I think it is a pretty close factual analogy to the facts of this case. And I think what Pacheco was trying to do was really sort of distinguish the Federal Circuit's holding in McPhee, because in Pacheco, the veteran was trying to use the grant of a non-service connected pension to then, as the thing that was awarded, to then use a medical record, a subsequent medical record, as an informal claim for disability compensation for service connection. And so McPhee had already held that a claim for service connection had to be for that a informal claim in a medical record had to be for a condition that had already been service connected. So I think, you know, to even if we go through the Pacheco analysis, even if, you know, you get to the merits of that, that the court is still bound, you know, to reconcile, you know, the Federal Circuit's decision in McPhee as well. And I don't want the court to overlook that in, you know, getting to the analysis. It wasn't fully really developed in there, but it is sort of binding precedent on the court. So I wanted to point that out. I would just say that, the rationale for why, you know, a medical record can't be used as a informal claim for a service connection claim, an original claim, is important, because when a medical record, it can be used as an informal claim for an increased rating, because at that point, VA already has all the information. The medical record is just showing, you know, potentially an increase in the severity of the condition. You know, service connection has already been established. All that, the other requisite showings for a claim, veteran status, nexus to service, all of those things have already been established. The only thing at issue in a service connection claim is the severity of the condition. And so if a medical record shows a worsening, that's really the only thing needed to really show sort of that, you know, potential intent to get greater compensation. You know, you're going to get treatment because the condition, and it shows that the condition's worsened. But if you're trying to use a medical record to establish sort of, an informal claim for service connection, it doesn't really show all of those other elements. It doesn't show, you know, potentially veteran status, nexus to service, an intent to file a claim for that condition. It could just be treatment. So, you know, treating it as an informal claim for a original service connection disability really doesn't, you know, it does not have all of those elements. VA already has all of that information. It's already been established when it's being used for purposes of an informal claim. So that's sort of in the background and one of the rationales for why a medical record under this 3.157, when it was in place, could be used as an informal claim for an increased rating, but not for an original service connection claim, because it doesn't really show any kind of, you know, intent and doesn't really provide VA with any of the other information to show, an intent to file a claim. But it can show a worsening of a disability that has already been service connected. And then I would just ask the court, I do want to point out something that was discussed here on a factual matter. There was a lot of discussion by my friend here about the idea that the original claim was for a bilateral foot condition and that was the claim that was granted, citing to Ingram and suggesting that, you know, potentially it was some type of pending and unadjudicated claim. And I wanted to respond to that by pointing the court to the record at 2162. That was the May 16, 1983 RO rating decision. And they list the conditions separately. They list pace planus under diagnostic code 5276, and then they list tinea pedis under diagnostic code 5813. So even as early as 1983, these two conditions were separately bifurcated, separately adjudicated as, you know, separate issues, separate claims. And, although they were claimed as the same, they were then separated immediately, you know, as far as early as 1983. So it wasn't one claim that was then proceeding together all along. It from the very beginning, these were separate and distinct issues, and they're separate conditions, you know, as sort of a matter of law, I guess, because they are, they have separate diagnostic codes in the rating criteria. One is a musculoskeletal, one is a skin condition. Those are clearly separate under separate diagnostic codes. So it makes sense that those are separate conditions and not one in the same, as appellants suggesting.
Do you have a position, does the secretary have a position about whether the argument that we should view this through the lens of compensation have been allowed as opposed to disallowed, whether that argument was forfeited given the procedural history in the case?
Well, I think our briefing does argue that the condition that argument was not raised and the court should not address it. And I think we stand by that, but should the court decide to address it, I think it would be helpful for the court to provide some guidance about how these relitigation issues should proceed, because it will come up again. To that extent, I mean, should the court want to, exercise its discretion to do so, some guidance, could be helpful.
So it sounds to me, not putting words in your mouth, that the secretary's position is, we want you to affirm. There are lots of ways that you could get there. But the one thing the secretary would like us to do in addition to affirming is provide some more clarity perhaps or analysis about when an earlier precedent is undermined by some later action. Does that capture?
Well, I think it would be helpful to everyone if the court's inclined to do that. In preparing for this, we found that this court really has not spoken directly to that. The Federal Circuit does have its sort of prior precedent rules and sort of explains, how a panel of that court will go about reassessing, whether it can address or overrule a panel or a higher tribunal, you know. And so, you know, I couldn't find anything directly on point from this court, direct, you know, expressly addressing that. So, I mean, should the court decide to provide some guidance to practitioners, I think it would be helpful because post-Kaiser, this is certainly, I'm sure, to come up again. And if there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Rice. Ms. Alsop, we'll give you your full 10 minutes.
Thank you, sir. Your Honor. I'd like to address the supplemental authorities because I didn't get an opportunity to address that. That came kind of a week ago. So the prior precedent rule is not invoked when we're dealing with a change in law, either by the Supreme Court decision or congressional law. And in this case, we're dealing with a change with a Supreme Court precedent. In one of the
you come from the neck of the woods where the Ninth Circuit has adopted this very high standard, right?
Yes.
And so the classic example where Miller versus Gammy is invoked is where the Ninth Circuit has a certain precedent. I'm going to be, you know, just be sort of the caricature of this, right? A super liberal precedent from Judge Reinhart many years ago. And now the Justice Scalia rides in at the Supreme Court, right? And what the Miller versus Gammy rule says is that liberal precedent is going to stay in place unless it is absolutely impossible to read it consistent with the later Supreme Court case. And so it's not just that there's a Supreme Court case. There's no doubt that Kaiser touches on what Pachinko did. But is it truly irreconcilable such that Pachinko can no longer exist because of the mere fact that Kaiser is in place?
Your Honor, I don't think irreconcilable is the standard in that they cite Doe versus United States, the Fifth Circuit does, that prior precedent has been undermined by an intervening Supreme Court decision. So I think that it's clearly...
But the Federal Circuit does adopt Miller versus Gammy, and Miller versus Gammy does say it is irreconcilable. Right now, that we don't have law that says that's our standard, right? And so, what do you see as the rule we should adopt?
The wave of the Supreme Court, Your Honor, is Scalia is riding high. So I would think that Ninth Circuit Gammy was not long for the precedent world. So I think it would be wise for this court to adopt a less strict interpretation. And I also would like to comment on the 1984 OGC opinion. It's unclear that was published, and also it was very factually specific on two cases that we don't have, or it's not before the court. It was also within the OGC opinion, it was a reversal of their other opinion where they did say, oh yeah, it can be a claim to reopen in two other cases. So it is our position that is not their official position, that 1984 OGC, not in the way that the 87 amendment published in the Code of Federal Regulations, where they clearly explained that the intended effect of the amendment, adding the 1 year, was so that it could may constitute informal claims for the benefits to prevent duplication. It was intended because they understood there would be claims to reopen. If there wasn't going to be claims to reopen, there would be no reason for the 1 year that they were adding in 1987. So the court should also consider that that's in direct tension with the 84 OGC opinion. Also, make the court aware that there are different facts in this case than Pachinko. The secretary would like to rely on that. But again, it was 2001, this is 85, it's a different version. And also we're dealing, in Pachinko, they were dealing with a pension. We're not dealing with a pension in this case, so there's some different facts involved. One thing too that the secretary pointed out is that essentially saying that Pachinko essentially did the analysis, but a huge difference between Kaiser and Pachinko, pre-Kaiser, was that you gave the secretary's or the agency's interpretation unless. In Kaiser now, it's the court is the going through text, structure, purpose, and history before considering the interpretation advanced by Secretary. So that's it.
I have a question. We have some law students here, so this will be very much a law school question, but I'm curious to know the answer, which is, when we interpret a constitutional amendment, we interpret it, you know, as of the date it was written to kind of get the plain meaning, you know, just to understand what was drafted. Same with the law, right? What did Congress mean in 1964 when they wrote this? Are regulations meant to be interpreted that way? Because I understand we have to use the operative regulation. So here it's 1985. Are we bound by the 1985 understanding of what these terms meant?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that it's close in time, and that's why I think the 1987 amendment.
I mean, I think it's actually much more favorable to say no, right? I mean, the term disallowed, I think, is much clearer now as not meaning what it meant in 1985, right? And
well, it's unclear what it meant in 1985 because, again, there was no court. And so it leaves it to the court's textual construction interpretation as to what it meant. I mean, we didn't have a court in 1985. So I think that it is written in such a way to allow for informal claims, and that I think should be read for that under that.
I would say, I mean, like the fact that the regulation is no longer, you know, it's off the books, it's been put out the past year. I mean, I think things would change very much if this were an active regulation and we're bound by, unchanged from 1985. And we are bound by a construction that obviously was no longer tenable, right? That we recognize just was inconsistent with how we understand these terms now. But I mean, 1985, I mean, are we stuck in that moment?
Well, I think to the extent that the court has shed light on certain things, then I would say no. But I mean, there's precedent and, situations like certainly Ingram. You're somewhat stuck in time because they've done away with the regulations. So this should be a veteran-friendly forum, and if he's entitled to some benefit, I would just like to respond that this was not one claim. I mean, in Mr. Rory's mind, it was one claim, and the whole reason that Ingram was announced was, again, we understand pro se claimants are not expected to know the difference between the diagnoses. And in this case, that's essentially what the secretary would have them do. He's supposed to know. He's got to do something different at this point because it's a different diagnosis. That's not fair to the veteran. But again, Kaiser is good law, and it has undermined. And what happened in Pacheco was that the court immediately, when there were two competing interpretations, immediately went to deference, it's a very different world post-Kaiser. Now the court is supposed to make an interpretation on text, structure, purpose, and history and determine if it's genuine ambiguous or not. But even finding genuine ambiguity, the court is then supposed to conduct an independent inquiry into whether or not that interpretation was really the interpretation, the official interpretation of the secretary at that time. And again, I would encourage the court to look to the 1987 amendment for that. And if there's no further questions.
Thank you very much. We thank both counsel for the argument and the distance traveled by, I know both of you or some of you. With that, the case is submitted and we'll come down and recounsel.